it straight, Africans get it straight. All of us get it straight, for we is great. You can't tell I that I's of a third world country when I don't know I's African. Not only that I's of a first world country, but it was my foreparents them who brought forth civilization. One of the greatest thing from the Almighty I know was the River Nile. Eh, it was the same river bank where Miriam did left baby Moses as a child. You didn't know, huh? And Ramesses, Nefertiti, Tutankhamun, and them, oh ho, is I history does want to tilt and chat beer filled when you don't know how them mind shocking pyramids was built. Just get it straight, Africans, get it straight. You must get it straight, for we is great. You better get it straight, Africans, get it straight. All you must get it straight, for we is great. Don't tell anything about royalty, cause I don't know his majesty. Don't tell anything about Elizabeth or Victoria, cause they would have to repeat the works of Ningxia, Cleopatra, and Queen of Sheba, of which I know they can't. So people, help me with the chant. You better get it straight, Africans, get it straight. You must get it straight, for we is great. Cause Jah love at the gates of Zion more than all the dwelling places of Jacob. And glorious things have been spoken unto thee, O city of God, Selah. You better get it straight, Africans, get it straight. All you must get it straight, for we is great. You better get it straight, Africans, get it straight. You must get it straight, for we is great. And the riches that they did rob we is still sitting over there in Vatican City. So I know the walls of Rome will have to shake, either a volcanic eruption or a mystical earthquake. Get it straight, Africans, get it straight. You must get it straight, for we is great. You better get it straight, Africans, get it straight. All you must get it straight, for we is great. And with constant day-to-day tribulation, South Africans are dying for redemption, which only requires the unification of each and everyone. You better get it straight, Africans, get it straight. You must get it straight, for we is great. You better get it straight, Africans, get it straight. You must get it straight, for we is great. You better get it straight, Africans, get it straight. I want you to get it straight, for we is great. Now just galang.
Uhuru, you are listening to Diasporic Music on Uhuru Radio. My name is Norman Otis Richmond, a.k.a. Jalali, speaking to you from the not-so-great white north here in Toronto, Canada, and I'm your bluesologist, and we have a very, have a nice show for you today, and we're going to be interviewing Wendy Motion and Michael Hamlin. Wendy Motion is MC, poet, and playwright. She's based here in Toronto, Canada, and we're going to be speaking to her at 2:30, and at 3:30 we're going to be speaking with Mike Hamlin, the author of A Black Revolutionary's Life and Labor, Black Workers' Power in Detroit. This is a follow-up interview that we did. We talked to him 2 weeks ago, but we are bringing him back because he has so much information. And we're going to be paying tribute to Bunny Ruggs, William Bunny Ruggs Clark, who was the lead singer of Third World, and he had a nice solo career, but he never left the group. So we're going to be paying tribute to Bunny Ruggs, and we should you should just kick back, relax, and listen to Diasporic Music on Uhuru Radio. We're going to we would like to thank two people, as we do every week. We would like to thank Chairman O'Malley Ishitella, the chair of the African People's Socialist Party, for giving us the space to do Diasporic Music on Uhuru Radio. And we would like to thank Archie Shepp, one of our mentors, for giving us the concept of Diasporic Music, music made in the West but not of the West. And Archie Shepp and O'Malley Ishitella both were born in Florida, Fort whatever that is worth. And like I say, if it weren't for Chairman O'Malley, I wouldn't have this space. If it wasn't for Archie Shepp, I wouldn't have come up with this concept, because really the concept is an old concept. I'm just basically running with it because we've always had people that have had a African international view of the world. So I'm just basically putting it to music and politics. And we wanted to take you now. We wanted to play some music. This is one of my favorite songs. This is the original Wailers, and this features Bunny Wailer, Walde Semayat, a.k.a. Peter Tosh, a.k.a. Hubert Winston McIntosh, that's Peter's given name, and a young man by the name of Junior Brathwaite, who is no longer in the land of the living, but he was one of the original Wailers, and they do a song called Nice Time.
This is my heart, and I'm gonna rock you steady. I'll give you love anytime you're ready. This little heart in me, you just won't let me be. I'm gonna rock you now, so won't you come on and rock with me?
And it's a long, 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 long time. We know how. It's a long, 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 long time. We know have no nice time. Do you think about that, yeah, now. It's a long time. We don't have no nice time. We'll be right back.
Chi-town for the worst winter they ever had. I'm gonna go right here and see if I can get this truck started right quick. These old shoes ain't ready for the winter. Oh, I'm about to fall and break my neck in a minute, buddy. See if I can get this key in this door here. I know it's locked and it froze up on me. Lock it won't act right. It's already half toe up anyhow. Yeah, I got it now. I'm gonna get in and try to crank this old thing. I'm gonna pat the accelerator a little bit. Almost got it. About to accelerate a little bit more. It's cold. That wind just whistling out there. Oh, that's a cold weather out here. It's frostbite out here. Try it one more time. Station, I think I can get me somebody to hock on down the street here by the block. See if I can get somebody to give me a boost off here, get my battery charged. Oh man, this stuff is in a mess here. I'll break my neck. Oh, get on by, man. I'm gonna get out your way. I'm in the street. I'm trying to walk here. Y'all running these damn trucks and cars and all. Well, come on by, man. Oh, man, the station is closed. Now the gas station was closed. And the snow was 8 feet tall. Thank you. Santa Claus. And the snow was 8 feet tall. The telephone cable was down. And you couldn't even make a call. You couldn't go out for groceries. Nobody would deliver to you. I said you couldn't go out for groceries. Nobody would deliver to you. In a bad situation like that, what in the hell y'all am I supposed to do? Yeah, tough one, I tell you. I'll go back out here one more time, see if I can get this thing started right here. Old Barry might be done build up. I might get it started now. Try it. I'm about to fall, man. I'm gonna tell you, I'm about to. Rough in Chicago. I'm gonna get on back across that desert, Los Angeles somewhere, Florida somewhere. If I can get out of here, I know I'm snowed in. I'll try to crank that damn thing one more time. I think I can get it cracked. I hope so. Let me see if I can get it cracked. Had to accelerate a little bit. Might get it started, yeah. Oh, yes. I got that thing together now, boy. She's kicking now.
Diasporic Music on Uhuru Radio. This is Norman Otis Richmond, a.k.a. Jalali, speaking to you from Toronto, Canada, and we had a nice long set of music for you. We were listening to Albert Collins and something called Snowed In, and a lot of people around the around North America can relate to that. The weather up here right now is snow, but we've had enough snow for a lifetime. I've never seen so much snow in my life, but Albert Collins did Snowed In, and we also heard from Gwen Guthrie and Peter Tosh. Gwen Guthrie out of Newark, New Jersey. Gwen Guthrie did a lot of work with Sly and Robbie, and they did Nothing But Love, and that is a song. I don't think Peter ever sang that song live, but I don't know why, but... he didn't sing that song live, but nevertheless, that's one of my favorite Peter Tosh songs. And I know Broken Hearted Melody by Sarah Vaughan is a song that I love, and I understand Sarah Vaughan hated that song, but that's one of my favorite songs of all time, Broken Hearted Melody. But we're going to be speaking to Motion, Wendy Motion, and very, very shortly, but we wanted to bring you back and listen to some great music from the original Wailers. And this is Bob Marley, Robert Nesta Marley, and Neville O'Reilly Livingston, a.k.a. Bunny Wailer, doing a song called Music Lesson.
Stay.
You are listening to Diasporic Music on Uhuru Radio. My name is Norman Otis Richmond, a.k.a. Jalali. The bluesologist speaking to you from Toronto, Canada. Joining me on the line is Wendy Motion, and she is MC, poet, and playwright, and she just had a nice play, Anima Spot, which played here in Toronto and in Mississauga, which is Mississauga is a suburb of Toronto, and we've never had her on Diasporic Music before, but we've had her on many shows in Toronto. And how are you doing today, my good friend?
I am great. Thank you very much for inviting me to be with you today, Mr. Norman Otis.
Now, you have a long history of doing a lot of great things. Can you talk about? First of all, let's talk about some of the books. Your two collections of poetry.
Yes, I have published two books of poetry. One is called Motion in Poetry, which was my first collection, and the follow-up is 40 Days, and they're both released on Women's Press, part of CSPI Press, and now 3 O'Clock Press, where I had a chance to imprint, basically express the spoken word and rhyme and lyricism background and traditions that I create in. So those are my two collections that people can read so that you can actually see some of my oral work but on the page.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Now, you didn't put in your bio, you used to do a radio show. How would you describe the radio show that you did? Would you say it was a hip hop show or hip hop plus other?
Well, definitely, I would say I was one of the founding members. Or I am one of the founding members of the Master Plan Show, which is currently the longest running hip hop show in Canada. Also, was one of the first women hosting a radio show on the North Side, a hip hop radio show. As part of that founding team, I was on the station for over a decade, and the show continues, which is amazing because it helps to span over various hip hop generations, not only musically and creatively, but also connecting the industry, connecting the community, connecting the scene. We had the great pleasure of being able to break a lot of artists, Canadian and Toronto-based artists through the show, as well as also being able to connect, be a voice for connecting not just art-based programming and issues, but also community, political things that were going on in the city. We would have anybody from Crazy Legs from New York City, but also be able to do an interview with Dudley Laws, so the late great Dudley Laws. So it's definitely a very important experience in my life, and I definitely have to pick up DTS and DJ Romeo, Lottie Dottie, and all those who continue the work at the Master Plan Show, and I'm very proud to be part of the alumni of CIUT 89.5.
Well, let me say that we wanted to talk about Anima Spot futuristically, before we end this interview, but I basically wanted to talk about get your views on the state of black theater in Toronto. And did you know, or do you know, of Vera Cudjoe? And are you familiar with the history of black theater in Toronto? And how much do you know about the history of black theater in the city of Toronto?
Well, I know one thing is that I'm definitely part of, I definitely stand on the shoulders of those Toronto artists who have helped to build a theater scene in this city and consequently in the country. Right now I've been very much supported with Obsidian Theater, which was founded by some very key and prominent theater artists in the city who have helped to set the foundation now for people like myself to continue the work. Also, I think theater has been a very, very important part of our voice here, you know, being able to bring out our community to sit and listen to our stories. And I think that when I saw the crowd and the audiences who came to see Anima Spot over the past couple of weeks, it really reminded me of when I was growing up and going to different community events and theater events that were put on by foundation artists in the city when I was coming up, and saying that this obviously our people, our community is hungry for this. We just need to continue to make stories that they want to hear and that's relevant to them, and then spread the word so that they will now come and fill the seats and support live theater. It's all about the stories and it's all about the connection.
Well, I'm speaking with Wendy Motion, who is an MC, poet, and playwright, and did a little bit of radio. But I wanted to ask you, the play that you did, basically, Anima Spot, was a very hard-hitting play, very realistic, almost too realistic, you know, a lot of choice words, I mean, speaking in a language that people speak. And I was there, I think, Saturday night, and you mm-hmm. closed it on Sunday. You had a Sunday show, but Saturday night, I understand, was packed, and Friday night was packed there.
That's
but
right.
The whole question of social media, the way mm-hmm. you guys use social media to promote your plays, that's relatively a new phenomenon, because in the, you know, in ancient times, in the 60s and 70s, when you know, people started theater, they probably still using mimeograph machines and that kind
right.
that sort of stuff.
Right. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But you guys, talk about how you promoted this show.
Well, for this show, what we did was we tried to hit it off on as many mediums as possible. We had a great team, right from the actors, Shamari Downer and Amanda Paris, a wonderful music director, DJ Eloquence. We also had our director, Charles Officer, all who have their own connections and their own social media, I guess, life and networks. And so what we strove to do was to connect on different mediums. So, for instance, we had we dropped all Toronto soundscape called the Anima Spot Mixtape Part 2. Part 1 came out in 2012 when we did our first full production at the Summer Works Festival. Part 2, mixed by DJ Eloquence, is currently on SoundCloud and on YouTube. So we were able to hit people and the artists that we were promoting through the mixtape, who now also became, you know, part of the stakeholders of this play, by showing that we have really, really amazing music that's coming out of the city right now. And because we wanted to make sure that this was deemed as a Toronto story, it's a story that's in the language, in the vernacular, in the mentality, and as a local story, but it also has universal themes. Secondly, we also dropped an edited trailer. We worked with Amber Williams-King, who is a wonderful emerging photographer, to create the images that would be able to showcase visually tell the story visually before people even walked into the theater. And our designer, Riyadh, also designed many different types of images that could be connected to different audiences. So we had an image that could drop for a younger audience, audience, like a youth-based audience. We had an image that would connect to a more mature audience, and we tried to basically be, you know, sort of test things out and be as diverse as possible. So when we talk about word, sound, image, and power, that is sort of our social media strategy. And then lastly, connecting to the blogs, people like One Love T.O. and BadPerm.com and Hip Hop Canada and M How She Hustles, etc. A lot of blogs then came on to do Manifesto.ca. They also all came on to do giveaways for the play and therefore also connecting to their social media network. So social media was definitely used in basically all the avenues that we were able to at the time, and it's something that we will continue to build upon for subsequent projects.
Let me say this before. I want you to talk about the play itself, but before you do that, mm-hmm. I wanted to mention Charles Officer. Charles
yes.
Officer did a film called On Harry Jerome, who was a great
right.
African sprinter,
Canadian.
Who was born in Canada. I think he made his contribution, I think he went to school in Oregon. But I remember mm-hmm. when I was growing up, the only Canadians that I knew coming from California, and I'll say this very publicly, but I only knew Norman Bethune
mm-hmm.
because he was with Mao Zedong. And
uh-huh.
and I knew Harry Jerome because he ran in the 1960, 64, and 1968 Olympics. And
right.
I was really impressed. Harry Jerome, I think, was a Commonwealth champion. I know he went to Jamaica, and he had the world record at one time. But
mm-hmm.
I would advise everybody to, you know, go to Google Charles Officer and Harry Jerome, and
yeah.
take a look at that. Look at that film.
Actually, right now Charles is on a Cross Canada tour, school tour, showcasing that documentary to schools across the country. Currently for Black History Month, and you know, it was really, really amazing to work with him, because we really had a chance to explore both not only the theatrical parameters of Anima Spot, but also the filmic qualities of Anima Spot through his direction and through his eye. So expanding what just some of the traditional strategies of theater, but through a film director's eye. He's so amazing, so talented, and has a great vision, and I was really, really honored to have him on this project, and I do implore people to continue to look out for his work. That one that you mentioned, the Harry Jerome, as well as the Nurse Spider Boy, which is his debut feature film, a really beautiful film that's also a Toronto story, but definitely a universal story about family and love and the Black community.
Can you talk about the Anima Spot in terms of when I saw that play? I mean, it looks as if it's taking place in Toronto, but that could have taken place in Detroit or
mm-hmm.
Montreal or
Chicago, UK.
Chicago the UK, or maybe in
mm-hmm.
Stockholm, Sweden, or you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, African people. But let's basically deal with Canada and the whole
mm-hmm.
question of carding and all that type of stuff that takes place here. That people, when people think about Canada, I guess because Canada has such a great healthcare system,
mm-hmm.
But the police here are not that kind. I get to especially to Africans and other people with a little bit of melanin. Or wouldn't you say that?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I would say that it's definitely a story that I feel anyone who's growing in what you often hear called the state of otherness, African people, maybe Aboriginal people, maybe any people of color who are growing in states of otherness or in a state of being deemed as a minority in these various countries across the diaspora, the type of angst type, as I remember somebody had put it, an elder had said to me, the angst that she found knowing that she had come to Canada from the Caribbean, you know, to basically expand her horizons and have her family and give a better life to her family, but not realizing the extent of the angst that those who have grown up here or are growing up here in this generation are really dealing with in regards to still being deemed as the other, even though they are citizens of this country. But the story, a lot of that is definitely the backdrop, the issues with the police, the issues with violence, the issues with just community instability. To me, the most important part of the story in my mind and when I wrote it was just about how, about love, it's about friendship, it's about connection, it's about healing, and it's about how the connections and the deeper spiritual connection between women and men, or young men and young women, as the two main characters are Anima and Juan, who are a young woman and young man who have grown up together and are now in a state of, I guess, a rites of passage, when you come to that bridge and you have to sort of make the decisions that are going to change or affect the rest of our lives. And so that is really the space that I started writing it from, was seeing these two characters so clearly in my mind, and then just opening up my ear to how, without thinking about, you know, how people are expected to speak and how we really speak, and just letting those flow out of my mind and into my fingers and onto the page. So there's definitely a lot of underlying layers in the piece. So I would say that the main part is just that quest for wanting to heal and wanting to survive, you know, in spite of all of the barriers that are there.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Yeah. And trying to figure out who we are in this context, you know, and showing that, you know, one of the main characters, Juan, who's a young man, just showing that another side of what is deemed as the, sorry, I hope that you can still hear me.
No problem. Yeah.
Okay, great. What is deemed as, like, you know, the stereotypical young black man and how he's supposed to be, whether it's from, you know, other people's eyes or even from his own eyes, and showing that there's more to him than that. So I think it has anger, it has pain, it has sadness, but it also is funny. You know, there's also a lot of memory. It's also, you know, can be very beautiful at times, and that is what I wanted to show, just within this real time space of one afternoon into one evening after a funeral, how Anima and Juan deal with the things that are going on around them as they vision and dream and remember together.
Yeah, he had him cooking the dumplings and the saltfish.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. Because hey, you know, we have to play with those roles, you know, because hey, a lot of brothers out here cook, you know, and they sort of play with each other's roles, the gender roles of what they're supposed to be. Like, you know, he's an MC, she's a poet, but there's times when he's a poet and she's an MC, and you know, how they use words and art to communicate, because there's times when there's no more words. The only thing that they can use to communicate is their lyrics and their poetry. And so they speak to each other like that at times, you know, their dialogue and their conversation is poetic, but there's also times when the silences also speak volumes. The music is also part of the storytelling and has definitely emerged as a character in this last production. The type of music that we use, some of the artists like Rich Kid and production by Eloquence, Ian Kamau, the lyrically, those lyrics are also part of the story. And so I thought it was just amazing to be able to sort of work within that multi-artistic, interdisciplinary type of vibe.
Well, you know, is there any thoughts of this becoming a film?
There are definitely thoughts of that. That's something that I see in the future. And so now that this project here is wrapped up, now it's back to the game plan and seeing what's going to be the next step. But I feel that it's definitely a filmic piece, and that's always been one of my goals, to have this as a film.
Let me ask you this. You grew up you spent some time on the African continent. Your father, Oscar Brathwaite, and your mother, Karen, your mother is from Antigua, I believe, and your father is from Barbados, but did you live in Africa? Were you born in Africa? What is your relationship with it's Zambia, I believe, right?
Actually, it was Botswana.
Even geniuses make mistakes, okay.
No, that's all good. It wasn't too far. But, yeah, so at a very important stage in my own life, I was when my father decided he wanted to leave Toronto and go to Africa, that actually opened up the door for me to spend almost a year there when I was still quite young. And it was a very, very important experience, because at a young age it opened up my eyes to a bigger world, and also to a world where, you know, where Black people were the majority, running their own country, looking at a context where African context, a continental context, and it definitely had a great impact on me, that stands to this day. So yeah, that's what happened there.
Well, your uncle is Odi Mumba Kwamdela, and
he is a rap poet.
Yeah, and I'm talking about his book, Niggas, This Is Canada, really caused a real storm, mm-hmm. and that is no longer in the system here. Mm-hmm. And he recently did a book on Sparrow,
right?
And, the mighty Sparrow, and Odi Mumba is he's in Brooklyn, yeah. I believe, right?
Brooklyn, that's right.
Right.
Yeah, my uncle, Odi Mumba Kwamdela, is basically one of the first poets and spoken word artists I knew of. His book, Niggas This Is Canada, is definitely a classic that I feel for me to read, especially at the time. For him to put out a book with that title, you know, alone shows that his audacity and his gumption and definitely his no apologies approach to his writing and observations that he puts in his writing. Because as a young man coming to Toronto, and he tells a story of those who came with certain dreams and certain expectations and, you know, got off that plane and, you know what I mean? And everything was so different. They had to community up, no matter where you were from, whatever island you were from, even, or if you were from the continent, they had to become just a different identity within this sort of cold northern climate. So I remember seeing his record, at home, and him with the afro and standing at a podium, and I just was like, wow, like that's my uncle. And I hadn't even started writing or anything like that as yet, so just knowing that that's part of my lineage is really great. And I have other cousins and even my brother and people like that who are now like artists, visual and spoken word, poets, dancers. So it's in the blood still, but it's good to know that you know, he has such a big catalog, and I would definitely tell, you know, all who are listening to you to check him out, especially check out Niggas This Is Canada, because that's a must read.
Okay, we wind it down now, but I basically wanted to say that your father and uncle, we had an organization called the Afro-American Progressive Association, and when we used the term Afro-American, we were using it like Malcolm X used the Afro-American to mean African people in the Western Hemisphere, and we used to meet at the Home Service. Home Service, I think, is 941. It's on Bathurst Street, 941. Okay. I think that might have been Third World Bookstore, but this is before your time.
Oh wow!
And,
okay.
Yeah, and we had a nice. We're a Pan African group in the sense that we had African people from all over the Western Hemisphere, and the founders of the group were Jose Garcia, who was, you know, grew up in Aruba. Another brother out of Chicago, and myself, and we, with the first meeting that we had was in 1968. We did a thing for Malcolm X, X's assassination. It was Jan Carew spoke. Yeah, Jan Carew, and there was a young man by the name of Ted Watkins who was killed in America.
Oh.
He was Ted was a football player for Hamilton Tigers.
He won a Grey Cup,
and they said he was stealing some stuff out in California. But that's some more history we need to keep up. Is there anything else you would like to add?
Well, I would just say that, you know, those are the type of stories that I think that we need to know. We need to know more about what is the background of, especially during this time, you know, that we call Black History Month. I've been really taking more and more to call it Black Future Month. I love that the people have been coining that term because it connects. Like, you can't have a future without history. So if we are able to know more about our foundations here in this country, I think that we will build a stronger identity, a stronger empowerment of, and especially cross-generationally, because what happens is that we continually are rebuilding or rewriting the script. We're continually going back to the beginning and you know, doing things all over when we do have foundations. But the fact is that there's not enough, or hasn't been, especially from those times, enough documentation that we can refer to. So if these stories are documented, then we can see that, you know, just the longness, the sacrifices that have been made, the movements that have gone on, and see how we're a continuing of that, you know. And I hope that, especially now that we are definitely in an age of very, very you know, just a really obsessive documentation, that, you know, as the generations move on, that this will not be as much of an issue, you know. So, you know, it has that this excessive documentation has its challenges, but it also is good. It's good in the fact that, you know, there's a lot there that will be put on film and put in on photos and audio and that we can refer back to. And I hope that even just like what you just told me, that these are the type of stories and facts and history that will be continually told, so we recognize really our lineage here, and then how we connect to the diaspora in general.
I think your father, Oscar Brathwaite, has a tape, a reel-to-reel tape of a meeting that we had at the Home Service. Now that's going to be problematic because we're dealing with technology.
Yeah.
And if we don't digitize that soon, it'll be no good. So
right.
that's something that
things will get digitized and,
yes, ma'am.
You know,
yeah.
Immortalized.
Yeah. All right,
yeah,
so I really appreciate it, and thank you for coming on the show.
Yeah, thank you for inviting me. It was really great to talk to you. Thanks for coming to the play. It was great to see you and Owen Meach and my pops. And one comment that a lot of our team made is that we know that you're a real music man, because when the beats would drop, your head was always nodding. So we said, yeah, that is an official music man right there. No matter what it is, so we were giving you so much props. Let's say, like, yeah, we hope that we'll hold on to that musical passion, like, you know, consistently as well. I love that. So I really thank you for supporting it and coming out.
All right. Thank you very much.
And just before we leave, please, can I let everybody know to please check out AnemaSpot.com. That's AnemaHS Spot, SPOT.com. You know, to check out the website, get the information, the bio on the team, listen to the music, and just keep connected to our future movements. And MotionLive.com is also my website as well. So hit me up and let's keep it moving.
Also,
thank
this
you.
Show in about a half an hour, no, in about 4:30, you can go to uhurunews.com, and you can hear this, and this show will be archived, so you can listen to it on demand. So you can add this to your arsenal.
I will, and I'll make sure that we spread the word as well.
I appreciate it, my friend.
Thank you very much, sir. Have
all right,
a good
thank
one.
You. And we have been speaking with Motion, the MC poet and playwright, and diasporic music on Uhuru Radio. Continues with a tribute to Bunny Ruggs.
Echoing my choice, you said seek, he shall find. I've been with you through all times. If you're thirsty, I will quench you with my love. And if you're hungry, I will feed you with my word. And all I ask of you is that you love as I do. The world to
Cha-cha love.
The only love that can bring peace in
Cha-cha love.
So won't you try love. Right.
your name. And he said, be not afraid, for those who believe I will save.
And if you're thirsty, I will quench you with my love. And if you're hungry, I will feed you with my word. And all I ask of you is that you love as I do.
And you are listening to Diasporic Music on Uhuru Radio. And I wanted to just say Nanga Def to all of my Wolof, to all of our Wolof speakers in Senegal and in the diaspora. And I would like to thank Wendy for a great interview. And I see my good friend Helena is listening from somewhere in the United States. I don't want to put her business all out in the streets. I really appreciate that. And we are building up a nice little, well, she says Ann Arbor, so I'm on Facebook, so she says Ann Arbor, so I guess her business is in the street. Ann Arbor, Michigan is a spot I remember seeing Walter Rodney and visiting Walter Rodney in Ann Arbor, Michigan, and his son Shaka was running around in diapers at that time. And Shaka, I think, is a grown man. He's in Barbados now. But Ann Arbor is a very important historical spot. I think Harold Cruz taught there with Walter, and they used to debate all the time. But that's neither here nor there. Bunny Ruggs, we met Bunny Ruggs many years ago with Third World, and we gave Third World an award for refusing to perform in South Africa, and the Biko Rodney Malcolm Coalition. And there's a photograph of myself giving this award to Third World, and Bunny has it in his hand, and his head is down, looking at this award. And we really appreciate Bunny Ruggs, and Bunny Ruggs. I remember speaking with Kenny Gamble, who was the founder of the Black Music Association, and he spoke Bunny Ruggs as a vocalist, and he did some work with Bunny Ruggs, but he really liked Bunny as a singer. But Bunny Ruggs was influenced by Nat King Cole. You're going to hear that a little bit later. But let's listen to a song that was made famous by Bunny Wailer, called Dreamland, one of my favorite songs of all time. This is Dreamland by Third World.
There's a land that the sea.
There's a land that I heard of all, so far across the sea.
Whoa, whoa, whoa. Do have you there on my dreamland? Would be like heaven to me.
Much of fun.
you know that we count each and every star way up in the sky? Yes. And surely, 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 oh, we'll never die.
Surely,
we got to live together. We live forever and ever.
To Diasporic Music on Uhuru Radio. This is Norman Otis Richmond, a.k.a. Jalali, the bluesologist who lives in the great white north. And we were listening to William Clark, who was known as Bunny Ruggs, who was born in Jamaica, and he made his, he joined the ancestors on February 2nd, 2014. And most people know that Bunny Ruggs from the song Now That We Found Love. And Now That We Found Love was from the pen of Mr. Gamble, Gamble and Huff, Kenny Gamble, Lukman. Yeah, Kenny Gamble is the co-founder of the Black Music Association and the man, one of the men behind Philadelphia International, along with Mr. Leon Huff. And we are going to play an interview, a part of an interview with Bunny Ruggs talking about his musical influence. Who was he? Says that Nat King Cole was his band. Also, Nat King Cole was Dudley Laws. Motion mentioned Dudley Laws, who was the founding member of the Black Action Defense Committee and a lifelong Garveyite. He was a Nat King Cole man. And a lot of people, I think, I've heard, I don't know how true this is, but there's a station in Columbia that plays nothing but Nat King Cole records. And Nat King Cole did a lot of recording in Spanish. And we're going to listen to Bunny Ruggs talk about Nat King Cole, and then Nat King Cole is going to sing a song called Cuba.
Your strongest musical influences. Who would you say inspired you the most, if anyone?
I always say Nat King Cole.
Nat King Cole.
Yeah.
Why?
The story that I heard about him, he was really a singer. He was a piano player. And the singer didn't turn up one night, and the owner of the club said to him, "You have to sing." And he says, "But I can't sing. I'm not a singer." Mm. And so if you don't sing, you're going to leave this place right now. And it turned out that the man was one of the greatest singers in the world. His tone, it's smooth. I could understand every word he said. A lot of singers, nice tone, nice sound. Probably it's a style, but I can't understand some of what they're saying. And in my thing, I try to each word, the person that is or persons listening would understand exactly what I'm saying. And I think Nat King Cole was the first person
that drew
singing.
Where you going, Matt?
Well, I'll tell you. Not so far from here, there's a really crazy atmosphere. Everyone is going there this year, and there's a reason. Have you been longing for the smile that you haven't had for quite a while? If you have, then follow me, and I'll show the way.
I'm on my way to Cuba. That's where I'm going. Cuba, that's where I'll stay. Cuba, where wine is flowing, and those dark-eyed stellas like their fellas, Panatellas. Cuba, where all is happy. Cuba, where all is gay. Why don't you plan a trip down to Havana? Hop on a ship and I'll see you in CUBA. That's where I'm going. Cuba, that's where I'll stay. Why don't you plan a trip down to Havana? Hop on a ship and I'll see you in CUBA. And I'll see you.
Listening to Diasporic Music on Uhuru Radio. My name is Norman Otis Richmond, a.k.a. Jalali, speaking to you from Toronto, Canada, and we were listening to Nat King Cole. And Nat King Cole was a big influence on many, many singers, including Bunny Ruggs. And one story about Nat King Cole that really people need to know is that he never turned his back on Paul Robeson. And he went to visit Paul Robeson, when Robeson was in Europe, and as a result of that, the tax man came after Mr. Nat King Cole and gave him some trouble because he hooked up with Nat King Cole. But Bunny Ruggs and a lot of other people were influenced by Nat King Cole. Now we're going to listen to some more music from the... let me get my script here. I'm kind of tripping. We are going to listen to Bunny Ruggs now talk about the sound system, Africa, and a number of other things. This is another interview with a sound clip from William Clark, a.k.a. Bunny Ruggs.
I'm going to divert a bit from my questions because you mentioned about groups all over the world and nowadays, well, I had a Japanese visitor recently and I'm always introducing them to reggae music and I said to her, do you like reggae? She said, Japanese reggae, that's troubling. We have a lot of dialogue and controversy and conversations about people outside of Jamaica adapting our music, embracing it, and presenting it. How do you feel about that? Whichever way you feel. Do you feel that we have been cheated, as some may suggest, or do you think it's a good thing that the music is now so appreciated and so large that other folks are taking it and running with it.
It's not our music anymore.
Good.
and it was never intended to be our music. It was intended for exporting our culture. What has happened? In each country that you go to, if you're in Budapest, Holland, you go to Germany, you hear reggae music of their language, their music. France produce more reggae music, make more records per day, reggae than Jamaica. My problem I have with it is that as far as the business side is concerned in Jamaica, it's not being attended to, and as the foreigners are paying attention to it, they approach it as not only music but as serious business. And I have a problem with something that was started in my country. And we are behind in its presentation. We are behind in its production. Wherever they play or record reggae music throughout the world, they will always need Jamaica and Jamaican artists and Jamaican music, because we set the tone, we pick the subject, we craft the dance, we craft the outfits and the colors. They can't do that by themselves. They don't know how to speak of social issues, because in most of those countries, they're not experiencing what we are experiencing in terms of social unrest or social rest. They don't experience mango season like us. Mm-hmm. They don't have the fruits that we have. They don't have the weather that we have. So they're very limited in what they can say. So they always adapt and imitate what we are saying. So on that level, we'll always be on top in terms of we give them. But we need to work on how managers manage artists. Be fair. Don't give us two contracts when I see one and there's another one that is not corresponding with the one that I have. Things like that. The business side of reggae music in Jamaica needs serious attention. Because it's big business. It's not, you know, it's in Japan last year, Japan Fest had an attendance of about 300,000 people. And there wasn't one reggae Jamaican artist on the bill. They don't need us anymore. The Japanese have the ability to imitate. I remember when I was in Japan in the early 90s or late 80s, when Tried Your Love was on the charts there, Soul Platinum. We did studio television station performances, and the camera weren't on the faces. The camera on the fingers of the instruments, the camera on the drums, and they took those tapes and studied.
That's what they do.
They start. Now, there's another thing that we have given the world that is massive, and you hardly hear anybody say anything about it. It's sound system.
Yes.
Massive, massive contribution to the world. In France, everywhere, reggae music has educated the world about Africa. Isn't that amazing? The continent of Africa and the tiny island of Jamaica has shown the world and highlighted what Africa means to us.
We were the voices.
You're welcome. Oh yeah, Efusa, say the Jah, no problem.
Diasporic Music on Uhuru Radio. My name is Norman Richmond, a.k.a. Jalali, speaking to you from Toronto, Canada. And that was Third World featuring William Clark, a.k.a. Bunny Ruggs, doing Lagos Jump. And Lagos is a place that I think everyone should see. Lagos, I've been there. And it is quite a spot. And the first reggae artist to perform in Africa was Millie Small. I always thought that Jimmy Cliff was the first one to go to Africa, but the first reggae artist to perform in Africa was Millie Small. She beat Jimmy Cliff. She beat Robert Nesta Marley and all of the folks. And I think the first hip-hop artist to go to Africa was Dougie Fresh, I believe. But we're paying tribute to Bunny Ruggs, and Bunny Ruggs is we're going to play a song that he did on the David Letterman show, and we're getting ready to speak with Michael Hamlin after we hear a piece of this song.
Oh, Bob Marley, he sang a song, says we're jabbing on the winter's side. I hear his voice, yes I do. There's no denying when I hear the truth. Well, everybody here, reach out and touch somebody's hand. Sing down as loud as you can, then raise your hands in the air. Everybody say yeah. Oh, so this word lives. Said it's living in the people. Let it rise up today. Marcus Garvey, he lives on. He told us people, you've got to be strong. One God, one aim, one destiny. Let Marcus Garvey live with you and me. Well, everybody here, reach out and touch somebody's hand. Sing loud, as loud as you can, then raise your hands in the air. Everybody say yeah. Oh, say the spirit lives. Says it's living in the people. Say, can I ask a question? Can I ask a question? Who do you know that can make the grass grow? Make the birds fly so high. Make the waters come down from the sky. And with all these things, I've done seen. Don't you know that I truly believe? Yeah, that the spirit moves.
Forever.
Say, you and me.
Forever.
Let the spirit set you free.
To Diasporic Music on Uhuru Radio. We have just paid tribute to William Clark, a.k.a. Bunny Ruggs, the lead voice of the Third World, and we love his music. We knew him personally, and we gave him an award. When I say we, the Biko Rodney Malcolm Coalition, a group in Toronto, gave him an award, gave the group award because they refused to perform in apartheid South Africa. But joining us on the line from Detroit, Michigan, is Mike Hamlin, Michael Hamlin, the author of A Black Revolutionary's Life in Labor, Black Workers' Power in Detroit. And how are you doing today, my friend?
Oh, I'm doing fine. I'm so delighted to be with you.
You know, there's a question that I wanted to ask you. Looking at the book thoroughly, mm-hmm. and there were demands that the League made in 1969, mm-hmm. and I wanted you basically to talk about the demands that Drum made. They made these demands to the Chrysler Corporation and to the UAW, which we refer to as a UAW, meant you ain't white. And
yeah.
In 1969, can we fast forward to 2014? the demands that Drum made in 1969, what does it look like now in terms of Detroit in the auto industry in 2014? How much progress have black workers and working people as a whole made in the city of Detroit?
Well, as you know, the whole country, the working class in the whole country is going backwards. But in our case, it's worse. The race thing is Reagan started out in 80 saying that he wanted to take this country back. And there's always been that the thrust in that direction. And it's little by little, gains that we made have been eroded. And in the factory, because the big three went through near disaster, as part of the overall economy, has made it so that if you want to go into a factory now, you have to be white primarily, or you have to know somebody who has got some connection to get you in there. So on that note, that's where we were. In the 60s, we took what we could get, and it was by and large the foundries and the staffing plants and steel mills, the places that were most dangerous, the hottest, and most difficult, as you know. And when Kennedy came along and introduced the economics of Keynes, Keynesian economics, he put a lot of money into the economy that opened up shot the business the economy up big time in this country, and there were jobs available for everybody. At the same time, because of the civil rights movement, Kennedy had moved toward making certain concessions demand because the black movement was developing in a revolutionary direction.
So he had to make that move whether he wanted it or not. That's what you're saying.
Yeah, because whereas they had been fighting for voting rights in the South, and they had been they'd won that, and public accommodations. Nothing had moved in the North. So they had began, as I mentioned I came back here in 1960 from Korea, and I got a job as the third Negro hired in the Detroit News. The big newspaper at that time in this state.
Right.
And so did a lot of, they had the first Negro, the second, the third, and then they just kept on hiring us until they got around 50 or 60 of us, I guess. But now, those jobs that we were able to move into as the whites moved into white-collar jobs and, other jobs, while we have moved into assembly and paint and, various parts of the factories, automobile factories. The whites were moving out because that's hard work.
I don't want to cut you, but there's one thing I think people I really need to know in terms of the workforce, in terms of the number of workers in 1969 was what, and what is it in 2014? We're talking about 600,000 people at the one time, or 300,000 people?
600,000 now. But it was not in the factory, but in the economy of 2 million.
Right.
But it's much less than that now, because the generation of blacks have retired that came into the workforce during that time. I think all but two of the guys from Drum are dead. I was talking to Gerald last week, and he was telling me, I asked him how were they doing. He said they're only two, I think, still living.
And Ron March, probably Ron March and someone else, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
But Chuck and, Douglas and those folks are all gone. But anyway,
a larger scale, on the macro scale, because wages are so low, and because there are no jobs in other sectors, whites are now coming back into the plants, whereas a lot of plants have had majority blacks. They had blacks president and leadership and management and so forth. That's disappearing. And see, there's no consciousness or no apparatus in the black community that addresses that, that even understand at this stage the class situation in this country as well as the racial situation.
Let me ask you another question. In terms of Detroit, what are the formations that are in Detroit now that are working with working people? You have the traditional leftist groups, but are there any black groups with a, for lack of a better term, proletarian outlook, looking at a working from a worker's
well,
point of view?
I mean, I presume that there are. I mean, I think generally, no folks in the league for
revolution, New America.
New America. They would say that they're working with the working class, but they mostly looks like the only visibility that I've seen has been in the in the community, in community action. Now, in the plants, they may be taking a low profile in the slow. Organizing process, but there's not much going on there. And in fact, I see that there is a new crop of reactionaries and I should say opportunists rising in the ranks of labor. Whereas we had a pretty progressive group since Drum up until the last year or two, and the best of those folks are on their way out in terms of retirement.
Right.
And so, but there are a lot of community, the Bogs are, they're doing good work, but it's mostly in the community. They're talking about reimagining Detroit. They're promoting agriculture in the city.
You're talking about Grace Boggs.
Yeah.
Right.
And they have the Boggs Center. They have a pretty large network. They're probably the largest groups in the area, and they got people around the country, and they just made a movie about Griggs, which has been shown all over. And
we saw it up here.
Yeah, and she's speaking everywhere, and got books, and she's got good young people with her. Although knowing how to organize black working class folks is not something that everybody can do, because you have to be able to navigate the racial issues in that in the unions and the workforce, as well as the fact that people have no sense of they've been indoctrinated and they have no class consciousness and no understanding of the real structure of the society. They all say they're middle class if they got a job,
right?
Nobody here wants to be working class or and the poor even, there's no leadership in this country that has a hold on the people.
Because even President Obama is basically never uses the term working class. It's always the middle class. If you listen to the administration, his administration, you would think that there were no working people. Everybody's middle class, right? Or either poor or middle class.
Poor, middle class, yeah. And, and people like to, wear that labor. People will tell you if they got a job and they generally frugal and thrifty and got a little bit of saving, they'll tell you they're middle class, without any understanding of the origin of that the class analysis and what it means to be part of the working class. And I do not see the leftist groups knowing how, they don't know how to do what we did. Very few people, they didn't know how to do what we did, July. The whites and the blacks. I mean, we embraced the black workers, we sought and we pushed them to lead, you know, and allow us to be, you know, and we were workers, but we also, they allowed us to lead them toward understanding their place in the economy and in the country. But I don't see anybody taking on this situation as serious as it is. I'm now at a point where I'm seeing the NRA and all of these right-wing folks in the southern states and Michigan are arming, they're arming
themselves,
people. And the question becomes, do we go back to where we were with the Panthers and the League, et cetera, saying, you know, people, black people need to pick up the gun. At least, do we want to go into a thing of saying we got to defend ourselves because the police damn sure ain't doing it. And you know, we recently had this Jordan Davis and Trayvon Martin and, you know, Sean Penn and various other brothers, young brothers who have been killed, teenagers.
Right.
Murdered. And, you know, and in most cases, the killer gets free. Michigan's a stand-the-ground state and also a right-to-work state. So, you know, you can, you know, an old person like me would figure, well, you know, the work we did, the risks we took, you know, things were going to be, we had a better hold on the thing, on things here. But now, we're not needed. We've always been that reserve army of labor to fill in when they were having a work shortages. I mean, they'd have shortage of workers, and they'd have shortage of the white workers were in the rebellion. They always used us, for example, as strike breakers in the 20s and 30s. And then later, you know, we'd be laid off, and as the economy picked up, we'd come back. But we had to live for years sometimes with no work other than what you could hustle.
Right.
Yeah.
Now, the book, go ahead. I cut you off. Go ahead.
No, that's go ahead. Right, go ahead.
Now you wrote the book with someone,
yeah, Michelle,
Miss Gibbs.
Yeah.
Michelle Gibbs.
Yeah.
And is she still living in Mexico?
Yeah, she's in Oaxaca.
Now, Michelle, go ahead.
Michelle was the woman who, during the invasion of Grenada, she and her husband were living there.
In Grenada?
Yeah, and she went down to protest, and she got arrested. And people here rallied, including her husband, who was here at the time, and got to churches, and the churches got the State Department to get her out of prison because they had locked her up.
Now, there's another thing that I really wanted to explore with you was the fact that the League had a relationship with brothers from, was it Yemen? And a lot of, we had a lot of support from Arabs. Could you talk about that? Because a lot of people don't really know that history, and, you know, the system has really done a job on us when it comes to the whole Palestinian question, you know, either Christians.
Okay, well, we had, as you know, they had brought a lot of Arabs in from Yemen to work
at Chrysler. Right, right, right.
And our approach was inclusive, and we decided that we had, drum folks in the plant, Ron March, et cetera, would talk to the Arabs. And these were basically, you know, folks who come from the lower, I think, working class in Yemen. And they lived in an area that's still predominantly, overwhelmingly Arab now. And I got to know they had some really progressive brothers and sisters here. I got to know some of them. And they invited me out to speak at their a kind of assembly, a group out there in Dearborn, near the, and I spoke to them and told them what we were trying to do, we talked about demands in terms of speed up. Speed up was insane. Could be insane at Dodge Main at times, as it could be in all the plants.
Speed up is what they want. They want you to just work faster and faster and faster, right?
Yeah, and so the rate may be set at 60, but if you paid attention, Chuck Wooten used to tell me that the line would be going at 60, and the next thing you know, it's at 65 and 70. And you can, he's talking about how somebody, I think he said somebody got killed because they had tried to run, catch up with the line, and it went down it go downstairs to another level, and he got caught in it. And I'm not sure whether he got killed or just crushed. But that was the thing. And the union wasn't doing anything about it. And the management did not have, they didn't have any respect with the union. They had deals with them,
right,
in that local. So we talked to the Arabs about that. They were, they were obviously being put into the worst jobs too. And I went out there and talked with them, and I had a translator, and we engaged. I don't recall everything that was said, but we, expressed a fraternal greetings to them. And as a result of that, we got to know some leaders of the Palestinian struggle who came to Detroit. And, we met, John and I met with them. John Watson went to Palestine several times and met with the PLO and some other groups who shall be remain nameless. But
right.
But we had relations with a lot of people. We had people from Germany and from France.
Sweden.
Yeah. And people who would come in years later when I was working as a social worker. People would come here from places like that, and they would be referred to me by some of the whites, like Peter Werby, who was the editor of the Fifth Estate and has a radio program. And
Fifth Estate was like an alternative newspaper in Detroit. Yeah,
yeah,
right. Yeah,
anarchist actually.
Right.
So people come by and see me all the time, and they want to interview and talk about things and about the inspiration that we were to them. So we got copies, 100 copies of Grandma shipped to us from Cuba.
Mm-hmm.
We got, as you know, we got thousands of books, red books and books on Mao and contradiction we had fraternal relationship with Vietnamese. Some of the women met with the Vietnamese women up in, as a matter of fact, in Toronto. They had,
right.
They had a meeting with the Vietnamese women up there, and women from the league went up there. And women
that was Marion Kramer and some more sisters,
yeah, and,
right?
And women, and, people in the league who were in New York.
Right.
Leo Lynn Edwards and various, and obviously New York had a large contingent. One thing happened, I don't know how people take it, but the women in New York raised the question about being gay in Vietnam.
Uh-huh.
And the women acted like they couldn't comprehend. The Vietnamese women acted like they couldn't comprehend what they were talking about. So anyway, but we were respected around the world, and frequently I was invited to Vietnam, but I never went. But a lot of people did, and went to China. Jim Foreman took a trip. When he was in the league, he took a trip with a bunch of people. He took people with him to China. And I used to, didn't I tell you I used to visit the Chinese embassy in Ottawa?
I think you mentioned it, but I would never really went into it in detail. The China.
Yeah,
well, yeah.
I did, and I told you we that I was on a panel with the Vietnamese ambassador to Canada, and
that was in Windsor, right?
Yeah, in Windsor.
Right.
Yeah, so I told you about the South Africans too.
Yes, sir. Right.
Yeah, we had contact with people from South Africa. So, but we were all in, Jala, as you know, being part of it. I mean, our life basically was given to that work, and fortunately, none of us lost our lives in that time. But you know, the way I was feeling, it really didn't matter. And I think a lot of people felt that way. We couldn't live like that. And I don't know. I'm telling my students now that I don't see how they're gonna live with what's unfolding here. They just haven't grasped it yet.
Right.
You see, we'll be caught again without being prepared. As this thing is coming down on us.
Well, I'd like to make a proposal that people who are listening to this show email me, norman.o.richmond@gmail.com, and ask some questions that they want me to ask you, because the next time you come on, you know, I think people might want to, I have specific questions that they want to ask you as an elder statesman.
Oh,
you have a few minutes on me, so I can refer to you as an
wonderful
elder statesman. You're about 5 minutes older than me, right?
Oh, quite a few years older than you. I'm at the point now where I don't joke about my age. I wish I was young and I could do something.
Right.
I mean, I'm doing the best I can. I'm speaking. I was just talking to some young people from the Lawyers Guild, and I think we've set up a panel at Wayne State, which is a school of 30-some thousand students.
Right.
And a lot of in the city of Detroit with a lot of black students. And I proposed to them that they get four of us to talk about the plight of blacks in the United States today. And they said they would do it. And they do things like that. They did a play, and it was you know, the element about the league, and I was a character in the play, you know, written in the play, not participating in it.
Right. But Mike, we only have 2 minutes left. I really appreciate it. We're definitely going to bring you back. But like I say, if anybody wants questions, that one direct question that you, they can email me. And we'll talk to you sooner than later.
Anytime.
All right, sir.
All right. Thank you, buddy.
All right.
And
thank you.
Oh, yeah.
And I would like to thank Sandra Force for taking the show today. I'd like to thank Mike. I'd like to thank Wendy Motion. And send our condolences out to the family of William Clark, Bunny Ruggs, and we will see you in the whirlwind. And until next week.